The following class was led by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on April 27, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Nice to see you all for this, our fourth meeting of Clear and Obvious Way Study Group. For a sense of inclusion, the sense of your voice being a part of this study group, and for the flow of this study group just to kind of keep moving forward, what I'm going to recommend, or not recommend, but I guess request or encourage you to do, is to, if you have a comment or a question, is to raise your hand and to actually speak it so that it feels like, you know, again, so we can hear your voice. That's one of the reasons why I really wanted to be, I wanted to, if possible, see your face on our giant Jumbotron screen here so that people can see you. You know, we do, here at Dharma Field, there's often just like a computer that people are maybe looking into if they're even doing that. And so we're still working on how to make sure that our online Sangha is here in the room as much as possible. And we added our special classroom cams so that we tried to get the classroom as much as we could onto your computers as well. So if you could raise your hand. And so I'm just going to give a few tips. I know somebody had said they didn't know how to raise their hand. So I'm going to ask the people in the room to just hang on. Just hang on. Don't get too distracted here. Don't engage in sensual misconduct. So if you are using a desktop or a laptop and you want to raise a hand, I found out that there are shortcuts for you. So you can do this pretty easily to raise your hand or lower your hand. If you're using Windows, Alt Y will raise your hand. If you're using Mac, Option Y will raise your hand and lower it. So if you're using an iPhone or an Android, this is how it was described to me. Click on the three horizontal dots that are labeled more in the bottom right corner of the screen. When you do that, there's going to be a pop-up at the bottom of the screen, and you just tap raise hand. If you have an iPad, tap the participants icon. So it is different than all these different things. Tap participants icon, and either it's either going to be at the top or bottom center of the screen. And then when that pops up at the bottom, right side of the screen, tap raise hand. So hopefully that'll help. If you still can't figure it out, just raise your hand. And what I'll do is if I see that you're raising your hand, I'll try to acknowledge that. Even if I can't right now talk, I'll say, I see you have your hand raised. You can lower it and we'll come back to you. So I'll try to keep my eyes on it. So I don't want to discourage people from using chat, but last week it was used exclusively from comments, or almost exclusively. I think there was one or two comments that weren't. But it was hard for me. What I found I was doing was reading the comments aloud, and then sometimes we'd address them already. And so I think it'll just keep the flow going, and I'll get your voice into our classroom. So that is my request. Thank you. All right, now here we are. We get to the recap. I always recap what we talked about last week just to kind of bring us up to speed with where we are. We had talked about the precept, the follower of the way does not speak deceptively. So that was the last one that we had worked on. And just to remind you again, with this particular precept, the concern here is not to parse all comments and then try to figure out what exactly constitutes deceptive speech, and then to try to figure out whether or not you're engaging in it or not engaging in it. Rather, what our concern is with this practice and what these precepts are helping us to do is remember it's just to bring us back to our intention, into our mind. So that's what our concern is. It's not to define what does deceptive speech mean, or to, you know, again, you can really get caught up in that. It can get very fine-tuned. I've been mentioning Errol Morris a lot, so I can't remember if I mentioned him in this class for this purpose, but I think I did. Talking about a movie called Standard Operating Procedure about Abu Ghraib, just to show you, again, when we get in this world, where our self nature is not clear and obvious, when we start defining things, how we just get caught up in these definitions. So we're not doing that. We're just watching our mind. If your intent is to deceive, there you go. Then there's going to be unrest. Then there'll be unsettledness. So just notice when you're trying to deceive somebody. You know when you're doing that. You don't need an official to come in and start going, well, in this case, I don't think you're really trying to. You know what you're doing. So just pay attention to your mind. Be honest with yourself. This practice really is about coming back to and knowing what it is that's showing up. And that includes all the impulses you have. Like those are really important ones that maybe you don't want them to arise. And so you're going to maybe even misrecognize them. We have to start noticing what it is that's showing up. So just notice when you're trying to deceive somebody. And when you do that, notice how complicated things become. Even if you think you're telling like a little lie, and then you have to remember now, did I tell Eric that lie? And did I tell Mike the same thing? Or, you know, then this starts to get complicated because you have to start keeping in mind the fictive universe you've created for yourself, to say nothing of the fact that you might just feel strange around the person that you're keeping a truth from or you're trying to deceive. I think I mentioned that last week. I couldn't tell a lie to save my life. Though, you know, sometimes lying was pointless anyhow. Like when my brothers and I decided, well, my older brother and I decided to smoke a cigar that we pilfered from my stepdad out in the garage, you know, so I don't know how old we were, like 8 years old, puffing on a cigar. And then my mom comes out. And of course, what do you think the garage smells like? Cigar smoke. And then mom's like, have you kids been in the cigars? Oh, no, Mom. And I couldn't even, she told me she caught me because of the look on my face, but I happen to know it was because of the smell of the garage. But you know, so you just notice that things get complicated when you try to deceive others. And you can also just notice when your mind is leaning, right? When it has preferences for and against something. When you have that kind of inclination going on, this is the kind of mind that lends itself to deceptive speech. It's not that you're automatically going to do it, but if you're already starting to get into that mode of operating, now you're in unstable ground and deceptive speech is perhaps right around the corner. So then we looked at the teachings that went along with this, which is self-nature is clear and obvious within the unutterable Dharma. Remember, unutterable, this Dharma is unutterable because it is reality in a way before we have ideas about it. So it is something that is not cognitive. It's not something that's rooted in concepts or rooted in language or put into a calculation about how it is that this situation will either benefit us or not benefit us. And it's also unutterable because we can't speak of it. You know, it truly is something you can't say. Once you've said it, even though that's expressing reality, it's not saying reality. It's not getting, you can't say reality. You can't speak of it. And to be honest, if you see what's showing up, you realize you don't need to say anything about reality. Usually when we try to say something about it, we've just put something on experience that is completely unnecessary, like dropping a hammer and saying, oh, I just dropped that hammer, you know, which we might know why you would say that if you dropped it on your foot or somebody else's foot. And that's just your immediate, I'm sorry, I just did that. But again, frequently when we try to capture reality or say something about it, it's just an extra thing we don't need. And then it goes on, not speaking a single word is called the precept of not committing false speech. And again, that's one of those things, you know, not speaking a single word. We just have to realize that whenever we speak, it's not going to capture reality. So it's already off. It's already off. And so does that mean we don't speak? Well, of course not. We live in this world where that is something we need to do. But we have to realize how potentially deceptive what we say is. We really have to be aware of that. And I'm trying to remember, I just heard an example where I couldn't believe what I was hearing because it had to do with American politics in some way. And really, it was a group of people who Mary's saying, really, there's something crazy in American politics. But all I can remember is that people believed one thing, and then somebody who was in a position of power, and I really don't remember what position of power it was, if it was a governor or a senator or a president, but as soon as the person stated something, the beliefs of a whole lot of people changed to go along with that. So just know the power of what we say. Again, whether we intend to deceive or not, the problem is whenever we speak, you know, we just want to watch our minds. Are we intending to deceive at this moment? Watch what we're saying. You know, so anyhow, that's what we'll come back to again and again with these teachings, is watch your mind, watch your intention. So that's where we were by the end of last class. Were there any things? Was there anything people wanted to add or any questions? Yeah, go ahead, Richard.
I was just thinking, it's just kind of amusing. I am musing on that. It's not always easy to know when you're being deceptive. It's not always easy to know when you're telling the truth, as it were. Especially if there's an element of self-deception going on, that can take quite some time before you realize that that's been happening. And it's not, we tend to think of this, you know, deceptive speech as when you say something and there's a kind of conscious discomfort because you're aware that you're not really being true to your perception of the situation. And you're aware that there's a motive driving your speech. But sometimes the speech is deceptive without you being in a position to be aware that you're being deceptive. And I wondered in that case whether it's more a matter of, you know, you are deceived when you truly believe what you're saying, no matter what it is. That if you're saying something and you truly believe that this is it, it's the end of the story, and you've really captured something there, that's when you're deceived. And maybe, you know, all you can do sometimes is to maintain that attitude of not sinking into 100% belief in what you're saying, because you may be self-deceiving, you may be trying to speak the truth, you may not be aware quite what your motives are or what's driving you in this moment. I think that's about all as far as I've got thinking.
No, that's great. And I 100% agree with you. So we can see when our minds are leaning, but if we can't see when our minds are leaning, when we're, as you say, caught up, and we'll come back. I don't know if, Richard, you can hear me. Your line seems to be a bit...
Is it cutting out?
Sorry. You're frozen. But anyhow, but yeah, no, I agree. And that's why we want to watch what we're saying. Because as this precept says, as this teaching tells us, not speaking a single word is called the precept of not committing false speech. So along the lines of what it is that you're pointing out, Richard, just be aware. You know, if you believe what you're saying captured it, nailed it, is telling the truth, you have to be aware that's where you are. You're caught up in that. It's just to understand that we have to be much more careful with how it is we're using language. And if we think we've got it nailed, that's where you really want to be cautious. You know, that in last night's class, we read that koan. We were starting to read that koan, and that student, when he was asked the question by the teacher, he just gave an answer. You know, and it's startling, because when you're really starting to get fine-tuned to something along the lines, Richard, of what I think you were pointing out, you realize that putting something out like that is automatically going to have some edges to it that we can potentially get cut on. So to be aware of that. So thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, it's not always clear to us. We might be deceiving ourselves, which is why we need to really just realize that anything we say is not going to be it. And if we don't realize that, we can at least notice that. So again, we can still notice what's going on in our mind. In that case, it's just believing, you know, buying into a belief that we have in what the truth is. Mike?
I think that if we're aware that the minute we open our mouth, in a sense, we're committing false speech because we're not capturing reality, if we have that attitude, then even though we may say something false that we believe to be true, we would be much more open to stepping back, taking a look at that, and we would be more open to new information, as opposed to having just this, you know, frozen view, like, I'm right, by golly, and that's all there is to it.
You know? Yeah. But, you know, last week I brought up those cases where I was sure I was right about kind of dumb stuff, like who directed a movie or what year something was filmed in or something like that. And I brought up broccoli and the construction of broccoli, which I did learn, thanks to Mary, that actually was a myth. Not quite the way I'd constructed it, but it really was a myth that there was somebody named Broccoli who had created broccoli. So at least I didn't invent that. I was just repeating something ignorant that I heard. But I was so sure of it, you know what I mean, that I didn't know I was spreading mistruth. Yeah, Mary, what were you going to add?
I didn't want Richard to feel alone. I was having a conversation with my brother over the phone, and it was a very upsetting conversation. And I was shocked to find myself wanting him to align himself with my belief. He talked about how gun control was a bad idea. And I said with such conviction and clinging to this view, we are a nation awash in guns. And what was shocking was my desire to move him over into my way of thinking about it. I was so convinced that he was wrong and I was right. And it really was really shocking to me how much I wanted that and how strenuously I was holding on to that.
Yeah, it is surprising when you catch yourself doing that. And we'll talk about that as we get to some of these later precepts too, about how difficult that is when you're in the throes of confusion, when you're, say, angry or something like that, to really see what your mind is doing, because you're caught up in that feeling instead. So Mary, thinking about your conversation, again, it helps us to see how these precepts sort of resonate with one another. I'm hearing the first precept in that.
Not to kill.
Yeah. Your brother, as he was showing up, was in a way being killed by your need to have him be in another place. The conversation, in a way, may have been being killed. I don't know if it got really heated or.
No, that was about as far as it went.
Yeah. So, but, you know, as I was doing notes for tonight, I was again really seeing this cross resonances between these precepts. So keep this in mind. Again, we'll look at what it is that these precepts really are helping us to take a look at, the three poisons of mind, which we'll look at. You know, so because they're looking at those three poisons of mind, and because we're talking about overlooking the truth because we get intoxicated by, or actually we're being poisoned by, the three poisons, and we lose track of Dharma, of ultimate reality. So yeah, thank you for sharing that, everyone. Any other comments before we move on? So we're a follower of the way does not intoxicate oneself or others. And that's the one that Steve always jokes that when people hear this, they interpret this as the precept that says a Buddhist can't have a beer. And it really leaves it there. A Buddhist can't have a beer or drink or, you know, I suppose any other kind of intoxicant. You know, we know there are plenty out there. And, you know, Buddhists not having a beer or drink, it's probably not so bad, you know. It's okay if that's what you don't want to drink. Alcohol certainly is a disruptive force in a lot of people's lives. And, you know, as we look into intoxication, we'll see what confusions it can cause for us. But one of the things I want to remind us is when we see something like that, we say, okay, so a follower of the way does not intoxicate oneself or others, so a Buddhist can't have a drink. Just remember, these precepts aren't rules telling you what to do or what not to do. And this is very important. It's easy to read them this way. And you can certainly use them that way if you'd like. You know, it's, well, precept says this, but that is not really their point. Their point is to help remind us when we've strayed from the path. So it does not have prescribed actions that it's telling us to follow or prohibitions that it's asking us to follow. So just keep that in mind with any of these precepts. And this one is one that I think really does get, I had somebody say that to me once. Geez, I thought you were a Buddhist, not a Boozist, because I was having a cocktail and I just went, well, this Buddhist monk drinks, So these aren't rules to follow. And the other thing is to remember too that these precepts, especially the way that they're worded. So this doesn't say don't drink, but of course that we know that's limited, but these precepts aren't limited to something very specific like don't drink or don't do drugs. This intoxication we're talking about is much broader in scope than just talking about what we would normally think of as intoxicants. As we can intoxicate ourselves, we're good at it in all kinds of ways. I don't even have to come up with a list. We can think of all the ways we use to intoxicate ourselves, to keep ourselves distracted from what it is that's taking place. And that includes Buddhism. You know, so Buddhism itself can be an intoxicant depending on what we do with it. In fact, I would say, you know, think about one thing. Steve Hagen sometimes is hesitant to refer to himself as a Buddhist and to refer right. to taking up this way as Buddhism, because there's that little word, ist and ism, that turns this practice into some kind of a thing, and perhaps dogma that needs to be followed. And then once you got that thing that's called Buddhism, and it has these prescriptions, and it has these things it's telling us to do and not to do, and then all these, you know, whatever it is that we're turning into dogma, then we had things to attain, perhaps our understanding of these teachings in that way, and we attach ourselves to it. And what are we doing now? We're starting to look at the second, third precepts, right? Follow the way does not take what is not given. And these teachings aren't really ever given because they can't be given. You know, they just point to reality. And then that getting attached, this indulging in sensual misconduct, you know, getting attached to what it is that's arising as well and the worldview that comes with that. So we can see ourselves very quickly engaging when we intoxicate ourselves with Buddhism or anything, any of these intoxicants. We can see that we are actually attaining and attaching to things. And it seems to me in particular that sensual misconduct, that third precept, really is closely related to this fifth one here. As we get caught up in what our senses, you know, what we see as our sensual contact with the world, with our senses, we get caught up with that. And when we do that, then we're stuck there. We're the cat looking at the pointing finger. We're whatever's dazzling us is intoxicating us. And that is what we're seeing rather than the entire situation that's showing up. So that's looking just at the precept before we get to the teaching. Did anyone have anything they wanted to add or any questions? Okay. Well, let's move on then. People are still moving up there, right? Okay.
You all.
Oh, good.
Ingrid just gave a double hand wave.
Oh, good. Fantastic. So, yeah, now we're going to look then at the teachings here. We have self nature is clear and obvious. I'm on my wrong set of notes right now. Sorry about this. I'm seeing words here that don't match. Well, no. Where is this? Oh, that's it. Yeah. So I was looking at intrinsically pure, and that's a follower of the way does not speak deceptively.
No,
right?
No.
Okay.
That's the next
one. Okay, good. Then I'm right. It's the way that this is on the page. It was confusing me. I was sitting there going, wait a minute, what did I do? What am I looking at here? Okay, great. So yeah, we have self nature is clear and obvious, and we've talked about self nature and its fact that it is clear and obvious to us when we're intoxicated. Obviously, this isn't the case. When we're intoxicated, things aren't clear and obvious to us. In fact, they're in a fog often. Like we really can't quite suss what it is that's going on because we're, again, hypnotized or intoxicated is the word, but we're caught at this and we can't really quite see things clearly. So we have within the intrinsically pure Dharma, not giving rise to ignorance is called the precept of refraining from intoxicants. So we start out with this intrinsically pure Dharma. And this purity we're talking about, it's pure. First of all, it's intrinsically pure. So this means that it's pure not because somebody has purified it. So we don't have to do any purifying with Dharma, right? So there's no cleaning of reality that needs to be done. There's no, as when we start to look at this intoxicating, we look at poisons or whatever. Reality can't be poisoned. It can't be intoxicated. There's just no way that it can be impure. But that purity we're talking about is just in the fact that everything is simply reality. It's pure in the sense that it is what it is, you know, even if to us it looks impure, even if to us it looks problematic, it is still reality purely expressing as that, right? So whatever it is that's showing up, that is reality in and of itself, purely showing up as reality. Reality itself can't be otherwise. So that means that our experience, I didn't say our experience, we'll just say experience. Experience is pure. This is a word Steve used from the get-go. I like that because it's just the way it is. So when we think we're in the realm of impurities, we can know, again, thinking a little bit about what Richard was talking, thinking about the beliefs we're holding on to. If we just start to realize we're holding on to a belief in the way they're operating in the world, we don't even have to know that we're deceiving anybody or that we're caught up in deceit. We can just go, you know what? I'm pretty darn sure that's the way it is. And once you say that, you can stop. You can pause. You can look. So if it seems impure to you, you can say, hey, I'm caught up in a belief right now because I know that reality can't be impure. It just can't be. It's just all reality. It's just purely reality. It's purely totality. So it can't be any other way. And this is something, again, to pay heed to, because this is your true nature. We keep coming back to self-nature. Self-nature is clear and obvious. That is self-nature. That's truly our self, not the self that we mistake for ourself, that we could never tell you what exactly it is that we mean when we talk about that self, when we talk about or think about that self a lot. Not that self. This self is the self that is experience. It's pure. It's intrinsically pure. And so what that means is that this is our nature. This is true nature, and it's already this way. It's this way from the get-go. So we all have access to it. We all can realize this or not. You know, it's just we can either realize it or not. We all can realize it because it's the way things are. We don't have to go anyplace. We don't have to start purifying the world. We don't have to do anything other than just come back to what is actually already here. And I think that's important to keep in mind. This practice isn't trying to show you something. It sounds like it sometimes, because it's trying to show you something that's not visible to you. And it kind of, in a way, it's not visible. Because ultimate reality isn't something you can see, but it is visible. And again, the fact that it's clear and obvious, it's just this, you know, I smack my lips because it'd be the way it tastes, the way it feels. My fingers are cold right now. That is totality expressing itself in these cold fingers. The cold fingers themselves are not totality, right? there are these things that seem to be showing up, but it's all of reality showing up in all the ways that experience arises, taste and sound and sight and smell. So Mary, did you want to add something to that?
I don't know if this is stupid, you can tell me. So if self nature is intrinsically pure, then is there such a thing as intoxicating oneself? Or is it the appearance of intoxication?
It's a good question. Is what does it mean to intoxicate oneself? What is it that we're talking about?
If there is nothing but intrinsically pure reality,
yeah.
Is it possible actually to be intoxicated? Or is it the appearance of intoxication? Or is that a false dichotomy?
It's a false dichotomy because that intoxication is self-nature clearly and obviously showing up as intoxication, you know. But we get caught up in the, you know, what we do is we get caught up in the appearances. We understand what's taking place. But the intoxication occurs in this way, that it's just that's how reality is showing up at this moment, as intoxication, as that particular way that we're overlooking reality, as that confusion. Does that make sense? So it's not really an either or, like right. If reality is intrinsically pure, can there be intoxication? Well, sure, it shows up. But whether or not it's inherently there, something that is called intoxication, right. That's the thing that then we start to believe in. And then it seems that there's no way we can be intrinsically pure because now there's this thing called intoxication right. That has shown up. So that's where it can cause us problems because we really do get caught up in that. We see something that's, you know, and while you're in it, it'll seem insurmountable. Again, like anger, when we talk about anger in a bit, you're in the midst of anger and you're again, it's, you're just confused about what it is that's showing up. And you can ultimately see, we were reading Joko Beck. She had some interesting phrase about this. And I don't remember, something like watching the emotion, thought emotion, she had some unusual phrase, Jed. Do you remember what that was?
Thought emotion.
Yeah, thought emotion or something. You watch it melt away, you know. But when we're caught up in the midst of it, it's very hard for us to see what it is that's actually taking place. But again, that's just reality showing up that way. So as long as we can start to realize this is how reality is showing up, rather than this is not reality, this is not, you know, intrinsically pure, I can tell. I want to get out of here. I want to get to pure land. Well, then you're still caught up in, you know, you're still mistaking what it is that's taking place. Just settle down. It's already intrinsically pure. So coming back to what it is that's showing up, and it might be confusion, but just coming back to that and realizing that's what's showing up and not wanting it to be some other way, which one, what's showing up? Sucks. When it's a whole dollop of confusion, maybe we want it to be another way, you know. So yeah, Mike,
I'm still struggling though. I mean, okay, so I'm not sure I even know how to ask the question. But what is the relationship between intrinsically pure dharma and not giving rise to ignorance? I don't see how, and maybe they're not related. Maybe I don't.
Yeah, well, it'll become a little clearer as we look into not giving rise to ignorance. But the way that it does is what we were just talking about, Mike, is that it's only in not seeing what's right in front of your nose, you know, the intrinsically pure dharma. It's only in not seeing that. Right. Say we get intoxicated. We're caught up in the things that are dazzling us.
Oh,
right. So okay. We get intoxicated. So we just overlook the intrinsically pure dharma. That's ignorance.
So we're overlooking intrinsically pure dharma by looking for something with an idea.
Yeah. Don't even make it that complicated. You're just mistaking what's showing up right now. You're just getting caught up in ideas about what it is that's showing up. And you can just let that go. You know, we're just by coming back, go, look, I'm caught up in ideas. You don't even have to say that. Somebody's got a question? Ingrid, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm struggling with this one too. I keep like thinking of different scenarios because I kind of thought I understood it. And then you said something like Well, you know, then it still is reality. Is that you're, I don't know. I can talk myself into circles on this one, but like, if you take, for example, I don't know, like someone gambling at a slot machine, and they're just gambling and gambling and gambling, and they're in a state of euphoria. And you know, from gambling, trying to get the big win, or maybe they win or whatever. You know, and so they're kind of intoxicated by this feeling. So then are they not, is that a state of ignorance? Is that not reality?
Well, the thing we want to be cautious about is we want to watch our own mind. You know, that's what we really want to do. So to keep coming back to this, because we want to look at what's happening with somebody else, or in the case, Ingrid, of this story, because it's just a hypothetical, then we get caught up in the conceptual. And when you get caught up in the conceptual, this is never going to make sense. It really isn't. It sounds like a cop-out, but it is literally, you just keep going around and around in circles. So I can't really answer that question, you know, and all I can say is what you really want to do is just come back to your own mind and not worry about the woman at the slot machines, you know, so you can tell for yourself, or maybe you can't. Again, when, you know, as Richard had pointed out, it's not easy to see when you're deceived, when there is self-deception going on. This isn't the self-deception of, we're going to come back to that in a later precept, but we're not talking about our everyday. We are talking about our everyday deception, but not the way we talk about it in the everyday sense. So we can get caught up in that deception. It can be hard for us to see, but we can just keep coming back to this moment. Ultimately, as we keep coming back to this moment, things settle and we start to see what it is that's showing up. Yeah, David.
With the compulsive gambler, specifically on a slot machine, when Sherry and then a second Sherry lines up and you just got one more Sherry to go, and it almost does. I've heard this on the NPR.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, when it doesn't be a Sherry, they recognize that as a loss. They lost their money.
Yeah.
They wasted their money. But compulsive gamblers think, oh, I almost won. I better do it again. So they are ignoring the fact that they wasted their money. They lost. They're caught up in their feelings.
Yeah, I can't remember who said it, but it was a well-known writer from the Depression era. And he just said, the problem with America is most people don't see themselves as poor. They see themselves as potential millionaires. It's that same sort of idea. Yeah. But again, so just to get back to your question, though, Ingrid, you know, just watch your own mind. That's probably the best way right now to think of, to address this or to approach this. So, Jed, you were going to add something? Okay. Yeah, Eric.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that I think I, like most people, have. It's easier to think about the one before this with the deception, speaking deceptively, than this one. And I think part of that might hinge to speaking a single word. That's pretty direct. Okay. One word, but giving rise to ignorance, that's a little tougher.
Yeah.
But maybe it's not. Maybe it is just like a single word. And that's what needs to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. Mary, you're going to add something?
Can we substitute for ignorance self-delusion?
Sure, we can do that.
Okay.
The reason we have ignorance is that what's happening there is we're talking about the 12-link chain of dependent arising, right? So then what we're seeing are the two truths, right? There's the relative and the absolute truth. To not get too much into the weeds here, but it's... what we do is we get caught up in the relative truth and we think it's absolute truth. And so we get bound to suffering by what it is that we're misunderstanding. So the reason ignorance is there is it's just going to connect us into that chain, which includes desire, you know, it includes grasping. Again, it's going to include some of these other precepts that we see. So I think, that ignorance, Eric, is that's that one word. It's just sort of overlooking what's actually taking place. But that's the first link on the chain, right? That's if you're, you know, feeling any of these other things on the chain, and you will, in a sense that there's a world out there and I'm in contact with it, and then feelings arise with that, and those feelings do arise, and that's just a sense of positive, negative, or neutral, whatever. Anything like that is going on, we can just see, okay, we're in potentially the conceptual realm if we hang on to that. So I think that's why ignorance is the word that's being used. Is it's about ignoring or overlooking reality. Oh, hey, and his hand popped up. Richard, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I think you just touched on it, but it reminded me of something that happened today. We often think of intoxicants as these things we use to feel better, the things we get attached to feel better. But today I'd been sitting at the computer and I'd been scrolling through the news and I was feeling terrible. And my partner asked me, how's it going? And I said, well, it's awful. You know, there's war, there's a pandemic, there's a climate catastrophe. Life is just bad. Can you still hear me? I noticed that everything dropped off.
We just got
a low battery wash.
Oh, is that? That was, we had a strange sound here. So yeah, go ahead, Richard. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Anyway, so I was in this state of thinking that things are just bad and feeling bad. And she just said, and also, and kind of left it open for me to fill in the blanks. And I kind of looked a bit crestfallen. And I said, and also, there's our daughter and the cats. And, you know, there's the backyard and, you know, going for a walk. Yeah, okay. And in that moment, I was really intoxicated with a bad feeling and a view of the world as wholly, a view of life as very bad and very painful. And that too can be an intoxicant, and it gave rise to ignorance in that I, in that moment, overlooked things that were under my nose, the texture of everyday life. So, you know, even just reading the news about Ukraine can turn into an intoxicant if it blinds you to, if it becomes so overwhelming in what it does to you that it blinds you to what else is going on.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. Right, exactly. These intoxicants are just keeping us from really seeing what's showing up, the totality of what's showing up, so that we have this limited perspective. We're in, again, our brain is in a fog. So I was going to talk about, thanks for bringing that up, Richard. I was going to discuss that word intoxicants. As I mentioned, the three poisons a little bit earlier, that's the intoxicants we're talking about here. We're talking about what's the root word in intoxicants is like toxic. We're talking about poisons, and these precepts have to do with mind, the one mind, and then they deal with the three poisons when we are caught up in or overwhelmed by. Something just flashed here.
I think it's still here, so I might as well just keep going.
Okay. Okay. But anyhow, so yeah, these three poisons of mind, then they're toxic. And intoxicants, that's how they function. They poison us. And anyhow, so the three poisons of mind are, you'll see them inflected in every one of the precepts. But as we move forward, so we're in the fifth precept right now. And I think I mentioned in the first class that these first five precepts are kind of like the universal precepts, in that everybody who is taking up this way recites these precepts, or almost everyone does, and they take up these precepts. And then we're going to move into the next five over the next few classes. And those are five that usually monks take up, but places around the world will also take these up as well. So we're not the only place that takes up all 10 of them. And these extra five really kind of go in depth into looking at how we get caught up in the three poisons. In fact, the next four, so numbers 6 through 9, specifically address the three poisons. So, and we'll talk about that as we get to each one. So, that intoxicant that you were talking about, Richard, absolutely. these are the poisons of mind, and they can show up in ways that seem joyous to us, or at least delirious, something that makes us, you know, feel what incredible, or they can not be that way. very much the same way you were, Richard. Last year, I got caught up in, was it last year? No, it was 2019. It was before COVID. I was getting pulled into this black hole about Trump first impeachment. And I was just immersing myself in that. It was toxic. It was just not a good place to be. It took me a while to crawl out of that. You know, so yeah, the three poisons of mind, just to remind us, they're greed, anger, or hatred sometimes, and self-delusion. Actually, these are translated in various ways. But here it's, we translate them as greed, anger, and self-delusion. And we've been talking about that self-delusion now, sort of over the course of this evening. And I've been really heartened by that because it really is at the heart of this very important precept, because this precept in a way kind of opens the door for the next four precepts, these discussions about the poisons of mind. And that self-delusion then is, again, it's not this conventional sense we have that we have a wrong idea about ourselves. We're deluded about ourselves because we think we're the smartest person on the planet, or we walk around moping around saying that we're losers or something about, you know, whatever it is that we might think of as a conventional sense of self-delusion. This sense of self-delusion is that deeper, really problematic sense of self-delusion of a sense of a self. I'm sorry, the words are tumbling out wrong. Of a self that is separate from reality, right? This very core self, whoever it is, and you just say, you know, Mike, that's that self. And that's that self I was saying that we don't really interrogate. We just sort of take it for granted. We know what we're talking about. I'm this self. You know, when we hang on to that, and it can be eye-opening when we start to realize, oh, who is it? Was it Cleopatra who said, I contain multitudes, or somebody described her as containing multitudes from Antony and Cleopatra by Shakespeare? And we all do. This isn't unique to Cleopatra. She just bragged about it, you know, but we are not unified in the way that we think we are. Right, we're unified and we're all just expressions of totality, but that self that we think we are, me right here, and we don't know what we're talking about, because when you start to be pressed on that issue, and we talk about this in some of our foundation classes, what are we talking about when we talk about the self? Are we talking about the body? And we can think of all the ways in which we go, well, no, I'm not really talking just about the body, because you know, if you think about the body, for example, you can think of it in a couple ways, but you're thinking the body is myself and you lose part of your body, then are you fully here yet after that's happened? Or if you're not in control of your body, and who is 100% in control of their body? Please raise your hand, you know? So then is it yours? Is it you? What's going on there? And of course, we know that the body also has all kinds of things living in it, right? That we might say, well, that's not body, that's bacteria, but it seems like it's pretty essential for us to be alive. So is that part of our body? How about the food that temporarily passes, the oxygen? You know, we can keep going on and on about that. But of course, none of us would be naive enough to say, yeah, I'm just talking about my body. So then we start thinking about all these, and the more you start questioning the ways in which you think you can define that self, the more you realize you can't, and that that self keeps eluding you. But self-delusion is when we buy into that vague, abstract sense of self. And that vague, abstract sense of self is some, you know, some thing that just continues from when you're born to when you die, and it moves through this world that's outside of it. That is self-delusion. And Steve says, you know, these are usually listed, greed, anger, and self-delusion. He says, really, self-delusion should be first, because that is really at the core of all of our confusion, is a sense of self-delusion. In fact, you can see when anger arises, you can see how much the self is caught up in that. And when we talk about harboring ill will later in the precepts, we talk about that as measuring the self. It's very much rooted in, you know, just what you can put up with. And frequently what you can't put up with is what other people are doing. Sartre wrote the play No Exit, and the realization in that play is hell is other people. Well, it can be if that's the way we're looking at it. We know that's true. that people can drive us crazy. I have a friend whose daughter can't be in the same room with my friend when she eats because the sound of her mother eating, and I know it's a disorder, but it drives her crazy, so she can't be in the same room with her, right? So we know that, you know, we can anger or greed. Greed, again, you can see greed is just, you know, coveting things or hanging on to things. It doesn't have to be greed in any kind of cartoon evil way. It's just when we want that thing. You watch kids do that. You know, I think I've talked about this before. You have your favorite stuffed toy, but you've had it for so long, you get bored with it. And a new toy comes into the house, and then you want that. And then suddenly your younger brother wants your old toy, your longtime companion, Lammy. And your brother wants Lammy. And then suddenly that thing you were ready to throw in the garbage to play with the new toy, you take that back again, you know? So, and we can see that's all about the self. That's all about this self-delusion anyhow. It's not true nature. It's not self-nature. It's self-delusion that's arising. And and then we get intoxicated with anger. We get intoxicated with greed. We can be intoxicated with ourself. We can easily see that happening. And we can easily see that any version of how we act out of that, you know, is in and of itself poison. You think about acting out of anger and that flare of anger. Look what's going on in this country. Yeah. There's something about that kind of rage that, you know, it seems like it feels good to us. It takes us away from our own misery for a while. But just know that people, that's us. You know, we are that. When we're angry, we're miserable. We're acting out of our suffering. Yeah, Mary.
I'm not sure it's, I think that kind of anger is very painful.
Yeah.
Because that's separation that's not actually there.
Yeah.
And it's a very painful experience of that, you know, putting it out there, whomever, whatever,
yeah.
Guns, Putin, Trump. I'm sorry, I'm revealing things about myself. but that's very painful.
Yeah.
That sort of anger that comes with.
But it's consuming is what it is. So the anger comes up, there's the pain, and then the anger comes up. And it kind of gets us away from the,
Richard was saying.
That feeling. That,
it is consuming.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I have anger at things. That,
really?
Yeah.
That's it. You're going to hell.
But you know what I don't understand? I don't wish anyone physical harm because of my anger. You know, I mean, the level of anger is such in this country that people who don't share certain beliefs, you know, people are willing to actually hurt people. And, you know, I have my beliefs, but I don't want to kill anybody over it. It's not worth, you know, or even somebody
else, you know. I mean, yeah, well, we want to do, you know, we got a couple of precepts coming up, not slandering others and not praising self. You just want to be aware of those.
Yeah.
You know, that when we start talking about other people and how they act,
yeah,
what are we doing? And when we start puffing ourselves up,
yeah,
what are we doing, right? So just want to, again, this is always about coming back to our own mind. And I have once again taken us past the end of this class. I know I'm a few precepts behind now, so we'll get moving because the next two kind of, they go hand in hand. So I'm hoping the discussion on that will move a little bit faster, but it doesn't have to. Again, I'm telling you, I think these conversations have been fantastic and very helpful. And so I appreciate everything that people have been sharing, and I don't want us to feel like we're on some kind of express train and I'm going to kick you off at your stop without slowing the thing. You know, we're just going to take the time we need to take. But I do know we're behind a little. So I'm aware of that. I'll try to keep my own comments a little pithier than they have been. So thank you all for being here. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.